Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. The new season of Frontline premieres next Tuesday, September 27 at 8 o'clock Central Time, and it is a two-hour documentary, The Choice 2016. It's about Hillary Clinton, who has spent decades laying the groundwork for her presidential run, and Donald Trump, who has, as the film starts out, a personal need to redeem himself from being humiliated by the first black president. If you now feel as though you don't know either of these individuals very well, you'll know them much better after seeing this documentary, which traces their childhoods. I love this part of the documentary. They got great footage and a lot of interesting information because you see the beginning of who they have become as 70 and 68-year-olds through their early years, their college years, early adulthood. Our guest this hour is Mike Weiser, and Mike has worked on this film. He's worked on more than 30 films for Frontline since joining the Kirk Documentary Group in 2003. He's an award-winning writer and producer, has reported on national security, foreign affairs, sports, criminal justice, American politics, and the global financial crisis. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Mike during the course of the hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we love to read your comments, is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter at K Dunn Show, and that's how you get a hold of us. Mike, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nice work, sir. It's a great documentary.
Well, thanks.
Because it really fills in a lot. We've covered these people for so long, and I've seen them for so long and done shows on them for so long, but I love the fact that you went way back to when they were kids, because a lot of who they were as kids we can see in their late adulthood, can't we?
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things that sets this election year apart is that these are two candidates who have been in the limelight, been in the public eye, both of them, for decades, who a lot of voters, a lot of people feel like they know them. There's been a saturation over the last year, a campaign that seems like it's been going on forever, where we feel like we've seen them on our television sets and our newspapers every day. And what we set out to do with the film was to go back and to look at their lives, to put the pieces together starting at the very beginning, to understand why they are who they are, where they came from, to get a better understanding of these two people who want to be president.
Well, let's talk about where they came from, and let's start with Hillary Clinton. I grew up very close to where she grew up, so I understand Park Ridge, Illinois, pretty well. I didn't know that she was, and this does seem fitting, captain of the crossing guards.
That's right. We talked to one of her close childhood friends, Betsy Ebling, who to this day remains a close friend of Hillary. And she talks about the first moment that she remembers meeting Hillary Clinton and being seated near her in class and somebody telling her that Hillary was very important. She was the captain of the crossing guards. And we talked to a number of her friends from those early years, and one thing that has been consistent throughout her life was, even then, people identified her as somebody who was ambitious, as somebody who was diligent, who was studying, who was always raising their hand in class. So she was setting herself apart even at an early age.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that's interesting is she was growing up and lived through a time when the role of women was changing so dramatically, so that I think it was in a high school yearbook or earlier that people were saying, oh, she's going to marry a senator, never saying, oh, she's going to be a senator.
That's right. It was in one of her earlier classes. It was earlier than high school, but they were doing the class predictions, and the class prediction for her was that she would grow up to marry a U.S. senator. And it's easy to forget now, I think, what it was like for Hillary growing up in the era when she was growing up, when the world that she saw and the community she was growing up in, it didn't seem even possible that a woman could grow up to be president of the United States or a United States senator. So that was something that she saw even from very early on in her life. But as she would get older, the times would change, and she would be right at the center of that change.
Mm-hmm. And a controversial change it was, and maybe still lingers. Donald Trump, growing up in a family where his father showed very little love, there were winners, there were losers. You had to be a winner. It was competitive. It doesn't sound like a family where there was a lot of warmth.
That's right. That's the way that some of Donald Trump's friends and those who knew him at the time have described the Trump household. Their father, Fred, was like Donald, was a real estate developer, but he operated in the boroughs of New York and Queens is where they lived, and Brooklyn, never made it into Manhattan. But he had a sort of stark, very competitive view of the world. He wanted to raise his children, and the boys in particular, to be what he called killers. And he said that in the world there were winners and there were losers. And this is something you can see that Donald took to. And it's something that you'll notice even in his rhetoric today. There's a lot of talk about who's a winner and who's a loser. And that's something that he got from his father.
Mm-hmm. Where did this come from? You in the documentary talked to friends of his who knew him when he was very young and said that he was at a very early age, since the age of maybe five. He was the kid who knocked the blocks down. He was throwing birthday cake at people. He was one tough kid who eventually had to go to a military school because his father didn't like his son's mischief.
That's right. I think some of it you can explain by understanding Fred, the father. But Donald's siblings did not all turn out to be like Donald. He had an older brother who sort of did not fit into the family, and a younger brother who doesn't have sort of Donald's competitiveness. So some people we spoke to felt that, you know, this may have been in Donald from the very beginning. He talked to one of his biographers that we interviewed in the film when he was talking to Donald about his childhood. He said that he thought that he had never really changed since first grade. And he really identifies himself with that sort of tough kid that he believes that he was in elementary school. Tony Schwartz, who co-wrote The Art of the Deal and who spent a year with Donald Trump trying to understand his life to piece together his autobiography, told us that this was an important part of Trump's own identity, was the idea that he was, you know, a little bit of a troublemaker and he was somebody who was going to get what he wanted.
Mm. And the same is true of Hillary Clinton, that she was going to get what she wanted. As he hasn't changed, she, it would appear to me from your film, has changed in order to win.
That's right. I think when you look at these two candidates and these two people as human beings, one of the things that stands out to me as one of the starkest differences is how consistent over his life from his early childhood Donald Trump has been, how little actual variation. There's challenges that he's overcome, and there are ways that he has changed his tactics and his strategy, but it is at his core, I think, very much the person who you see on the campaign trail today is somebody who would be identifiable to his friends who knew him when he was young, and that was something that they told us. Whereas Hillary Clinton, as you watch it over her life, you can see how she has been shaped by the times that she is in. She's undergone a number of transformations as she's gotten older. We begin the film with one of the most dramatic transformations, which is in Arkansas after Bill Clinton is elected governor. He's only governor for 2 years. Then he loses. And some of the blame in Arkansas was on her for keeping her maiden name, for not fitting into the traditional role of first lady in Arkansas, for sort of wearing the types of clothes that she was wearing. And she underwent a transformation. She decided to change her name and become Hillary Rodham Clinton. She lost the glasses and changed the types of clothes that she wore. And she invited in a political consultant, Dick Morris, to help them take a tougher approach to politics. And that's something that you see throughout her life, is her understanding the environment that they're in, particularly politically, and then adjusting to that.
Mm-hmm.
And at least on the outside, changing herself and transforming.
And she calls Dick Morris in again. You have Robert Reich featured in the film because he was a friend of both Bill and Hillary at Yale, and of course was in the administration for the first some years of this. But he describes Dick as being this incredibly narcissistic, nasty guy.
That's right. Reich describes him as ghastly, which I think says as much about Reich and the way that he was understanding what was going on during those years of the Clinton presidency as it does about Dick Morris. I mean, Reich is a fascinating character.
Mm-hmm.
He first meets Hillary when she is in college, and he is at Dartmouth, and they then both go to Yale Law School. They are both interested in politics and in sort of progressive and liberal causes. They stay close friends throughout her life up until the Clinton presidency, when he is named Secretary of Labor. And he's in the administration as he watches another transformation that happens. And it's a transformation after the first midterm loss in the Clinton administration, the Gingrich Revolution. And he sort of watches in horror, as he describes it, as Dick Morris comes in, and this is the era of triangulation, and is pushing secretly President Clinton and the First Lady to change their stance on some issues, to take take over some sort of conservative issues, and he's also giving advice to the First Lady that she needs to step back from policy. And it's a compromise that's very hard for Reich, who told us, he'd move to Washington to be part of the administration, and then to see Dick Morris, invited secretly into the White House was very difficult for him.
Yeah.
For somebody who was so close to Hillary.
And then to see Hillary showing off the Christmas tree instead of fashioning health care.
That's right. I mean, this is an amazing scene.
It is, really.
You know, 5 days into the Clinton presidency, Bill Clinton names Hillary to head the health care task force. But those first 2 years are tumultuous and difficult, and there's scandal and controversy, and the health care task force collapses, and she receives a lot of the blame. And Dick Morris says that one of the problems inside the White House is that people view Hillary Clinton as being too powerful. And that makes Bill Clinton look weak. And he says, he tells us in an interview that he told her she needed to step back, not spend so much time in the West Wing, and take on a more traditional role. And at this Christmas tree ceremony, the woman who had been in charge of President Bill Clinton's most important domestic policy initiative during his first 2 years is showing off the Christmas tree in a green dress,
right?
And it's an amazing thing to watch. And you, I think, just from watching the footage, you can see how difficult that must be for her.
Absolutely. Early on in the film, you have this, and I remember this moment so well, Donald Trump, who tries to get an invitation to the Washington Correspondents' Dinner, where people are roasted, and it's an amazing thing to watch again, because he's sitting there, and he is just really roasted by the president of the United States without missing a beat, and he hammers him and hammers him and hammers him. David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, says on the film that Trump was absolutely steaming that evening, and maybe that was a defining moment for him. The ultimate revenge to get back at what the president said about him was to he himself, Donald Trump, become the most powerful man in the world.
That's right. And one of Donald Trump's key political advisors, Roger Stone, told us that that may have been the moment when he resolved to run for president. That here was Donald Trump in front of the elite of Washington, journalists, policymakers, politicians, and he is ridiculed really mercilessly by the president 4 minutes Omarosa, who was a contestant on The Apprentice and who knows Trump and is now involved in the campaign, tells us that it seemed like it was going on forever. And, you know, whether that moment was the moment when he decided to run for president, I think it tells you a lot about Donald Trump and a lot about what does motivate him. Because I think you can see looking over his life that there's always a need that he has for approval. He, as one of his biographers told us, hates humiliation. Mm-hmm. And he's also, since early in his career, he's been rejected by some of the elites that he tried to join. In New York, early on, the sort of elites of real estate saw this guy from the boroughs who came in and is so brash and said he wasn't one of us. And Omarosa, who, as I said, is part of his campaign now, told us that, you know, the presidency for Trump is a chance to prove the critics wrong. And she says to make the critics bow down to him, that this would be the ultimate redemptive moment for him if he were to be elected president. Pretty amazing.
You do indicate that he was feeling around, maybe running for president, seeing what the waters were like back in 88, wasn't he?
That's right. And almost everybody that we spoke to, including Roger Stone, who organized this famous trip to New Hampshire, where Donald Trump was testing the waters of a presidential exploratory committee in 1988, told us that it wasn't serious in 1988. He'd had a book coming out, The Art of the Deal, and they realized that a great way to get publicity was to say that you were running for president. And the press would come out, and they would cover you, and he got a lot of free media out of it. But it may have also planted the notion in his mind, and a notion that would never go away, which is one of the things that the co-author of The Art of the Deal told us, was that he thinks that that moment back in 1988 may have planted an inkling inside Trump that, you know, maybe he could do this, and maybe this was the next move.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. I know that the audience hasn't had a chance. We're just pumping you up to see the documentary next Tuesday. I did have a chance to see it yesterday, and it's definitely worth your while. It's the kickoff of the Frontline documentary series for this season. Mike Weiser is has worked on the film The Choice 2016. It's a 2-hour documentary that looks at the lives, starting from important times in childhood, of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and goes all the way up until now. It's a dual biography and extremely informative. Lots of it. You think you know everything about these people, but you don't, because you learn things during the course of the film and why they are who they are now, in some cases based on who they were when they were very young people. Our phone number, if you would like to talk with Mike. Mike is an award-winning writer and producer. He has reported on national security, foreign affairs, criminal justice, American politics, the global financial crisis. He has worked on more than 30 films for Frontline. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we like to read your comments, and we have some of them coming in already, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Pick any time in the lives of either of these two people who are running for president, and you'll get some information. Lots of calls coming in. We'll be with our callers in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Mike, and we start with Marge in Oconomowoc. Hey, Marge.
Hi.
Hi.
I know who I'm voting for, but as a result of watching the documentary, do you think if somebody's sitting on that post right in the middle of, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that for him or her, does it tend to maybe push you one way or another?
Well, we definitely set out the Choice is a series we've been doing on the candidates since 1988. And the idea behind the film is to give voters as much information about who the candidates are and where they come from as possible. So we certainly hope it will help voters to make up their mind. But where it may push them one way or the other, I think, does depend on your perspective and which of those traits you know, you're attracted to as a voter.
Right. Okay. All right. That's good info. I'm looking forward to seeing the series.
Thanks, Marge. Thanks for the call. Brad in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. It's Brad Lichtenstein. Hi,
Kathleen. Hi, Brad. Brad is a documentary filmmaker whose wife just got a MacArthur Genius Award. Congratulations, Brad. That's great.
Congratulations.
That's true. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
And hi to your guest. I actually worked on The Choice 96 years ago.
Oh.
And I wanted to ask a question that I know we wrestled with. I'm wondering how you wrestled with, you know, in a presidential campaign where every single aspect of it is covered ad nauseum by multiple media networks. What's the conversation, the challenge you guys wrestled with yourselves to make it interesting and to make it fresh and make it relevant and important?
I think that it's definitely a challenge. Of all of the films that we have worked on, and this is the third choice that I've worked on, I think that they're the hardest films to do because you're in that media environment where everybody is talking about the candidates and everybody is also exploring the biography of the candidates. And so what we set out to do to set our project apart from everybody else was to try to connect the dots in a way that would help you understand who the candidates were and why. So that when you watch the debate on Monday and see the different approaches that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will take towards answering questions, that the film would be able to inform you as to why. Why do they take those particular tactics and techniques, and where have you seen them before in their lives?
And so for you, was that something that was mostly a matter of digging up material that people maybe have forgotten or not seen before? Or was it a matter of how you crafted the story, all these things? I wonder if you could talk a little more deeply about that.
Sure. I mean, we start every project by reading everything that we possibly can. And we try to identify what seem to be the crucial moments and the most important things that we're going to focus on. And then it's going out in the interviews and talking to people who actually know them. And I think that's where some of the most revealing insights are. And as you probably know, one of the luxuries that we have, besides the amount of time that we have to make the film, which is months, is also we have the time in the interviews to spend in 2, 3, in some cases even 4 hours, sitting down talking to somebody about everything that they know. And not all of that makes it in the film, of course, but it does all inform the film that we make in the end.
So was there something, and then I'll get off and give other people a chance, but was there something in particular that you learned about each candidate that maybe you didn't know, flat out didn't know, or something that revealed an insight for you that you did not have before you started working on the project?
Absolutely. I mean, I felt like both of the candidates were sort of so familiar to me, but there were things that stood out as very surprising. One of them, there's a well-known to some people moment in Hillary Clinton's early story when she's at Wellesley and gives a commencement address. She's the first woman at Wellesley, the first student to give the commencement address, and she comes up after the Massachusetts Senator Brooke and basically has a rebuttal of him. And it's a moment that lands her in Life magazine and makes her into a celebrity. And it's a real moment of transformation of her entering a different world. And I think it really does shape the rest of her life. And I think it was certainly a side of her that I had not seen. And you can see it also in the early footage of Hillary. You see a very different person, somebody who's a lot less guarded. Who's a lot more idealistic, who hasn't been through the Washington Wars and sees the world differently. And I think it informs the way she understands things now. So that was certainly fascinating. On Donald Trump's side, one of the most interesting things was how much one of his early political mentors was Roy Cohn, who had made a name for himself in the McCarthy hearings and who really gave Trump a lot of the political tools that he continues to use today. He was somebody who taught Trump that if you get hit, you got to hit back 10 times harder, that there's no such thing as bad publicity, that you just got to keep your name in the press and don't worry about what it is that they're saying to you. And to see that there was a sort of central political mentor who shaped Trump's life and where you can understand how he's operating today from that was fascinating.
Yeah. In terms of the Hillary, thanks, Brad, so much, and congratulations all around to your family. It's a great day for you. Going back to the Wellesley announcement, it indicated from the film that she was listening to this senator and was appalled by what he was saying. So she delivered essentially a different kind of speech. She was writing down notes while he was speaking and then gave a rebuttal on right at that moment.
That's right.
That is what she did. Yeah.
And this is Hillary. Hillary Clinton was raised in a Republican household. Her father was a supporter of Barry Goldwater. She was herself a Goldwater girl. And she had a slow political transformation that probably began around the time she joined a church group and went to hear Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. But by 1968, after King's assassination, Robert Kennedy's, and then she goes to she's outside of the Democratic Convention in Chicago and sees the violence there. She really has a moment where her politics change, like a lot of people of her generation. That was a year that changed the country and also changed Hillary Rodham. Mm-hmm. And when Senator Brooke stands up, and sort of the way one of her classmates at Wellesley tells us, referred to the protesters as sort of ne'er-do-wells who should be quiet. Hillary felt like she couldn't come up after that and not respond, and so she does, and she does it extemporaneously, and it really does turn her into a celebrity at a very early age.
Let's talk a little bit about Roy Cohn, who all of a sudden, you know how you read something and all of a sudden that person is omnipresent. Roy Cohn, of course, figuring prominently in the great new book about Bobby Kennedy, Larry Tye's book, in which he writes a lot about their relationship. But Cohn, and it's almost as though Cohn is kind of a role model or a mentor for Donald Trump. And isn't he the lawyer when he's accused, he and his father, of housing discrimination?
That's right. I think it is right to think of Roy Cohn as a mentor. I think Trump really had two mentors. He had his father, who taught him a lot about the real estate business. And then as Trump wanted to sort of exceed what his father had done and move into Manhattan, he needed somebody to advise him on the politics of Manhattan. You know, growing up in the boroughs, this wasn't something that Donald learned, you know, in the family, though they were politically connected inside New York. And Cohn offered him, he was a fixer, he was a lawyer, he was an advisor, who really gave Trump a way of operating. And it's a way of operating that he, you know, continues to use to this day, and you can see evidence of it in his campaign. But yes, you're right that that there was a civil rights discrimination lawsuit against Donald Trump and his father for discriminating against potential renters who are black. And the federal government thought that they had a basically iron-tight case against the Trump Organization for discriminating against blacks, that they had documentation, that they were making notes in the files to say this person was, you know, C for colored and would not get an apartment. But what Donald Trump, when Roy Cohn as his lawyer, did was fire back. They filed a $100 million lawsuit against the federal government, counter lawsuit, which didn't go anywhere and ended up you know, not they did not win that lawsuit. But in the press, it was a way of muddying the waters. And at the end of the day, they settled without admitting wrongdoing, and Donald Trump declared victory. And that was a strategy he learned from Roy Cohn.
Mm-hmm. This email comes in from Gary. The description that you gave earlier about the competitive nature of Donald Trump's upbringing sounds exactly like the description of the driven and competitive nature of the Kennedy family with his boys. I find that an interesting observation, particularly when I ponder how the media describes the two.
That certainly is an interesting comparison, and it certainly was by all accounts just a central part of the life inside the Trump family home. And it was a competition that his brother Freddie didn't thrive at, and apparently that was tough on him. One of the biographers in the film tells us that Trump said his brother Freddie became an airline pilot, and they would say to him, "Well, what's the difference between, you know, being a bus driver and an airline pilot?" And they just didn't view him as a winner. So it was a tough environment.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Bill Clinton and his women and Hillary Clinton's response to it. In the documentary, we again see her on 60 Minutes standing by her guy, even though she's not standing by her guy, but standing by her guy because she doesn't believe that what Jennifer Flowers has said is true about her husband. I don't know if she believed it or not, and maybe you know the answer to this. And then later, you know, he is lying to her again, it would appear, which is hard to understand why you would stand by something who so publicly lied about Monica Lewinsky, and all of these women who are on his staff are saying, standing up for him, and she's standing up for him, and it wasn't the truth. It's just a really bad time in their lives. So two questions. Did she know what the truth was? And why didn't she just say, that's it?
Well, I think to answer the first question, I think only Hillary Clinton could answer that question of whether she knew the truth. From people we've talked to, she probably knew about other women. Whether she specifically knew about Jennifer Flowers or Monica Lewinsky really is a question that you'd have to put to her. But I think to answer the second question of why does she do it when these allegations come out, first in the 92 campaign for president, early on, Jennifer Flowers comes out and alleges an affair, and Hillary, in this extraordinary moment on 60 Minutes after the Super Bowl, sits next to Bill Clinton, and they respond to the allegations. And it's enough to get Bill Clinton the comeback that he wanted in New Hampshire. And you have to remember, at that point, they had been on a political partnership for decades. And they, according to people who knew them, believed in the righteousness of what they were doing, and to give up at that point, aside from whether she believed him or not, would be hard to imagine. They'd invested an awful lot into this partnership and into getting to where they had gotten.
Mm-hmm. And well, let's talk about Donald Trump and his women. Did he sort of feel that the way to go, the life that he wanted to live, was a Hugh Hefner playboy kind of life? Because it sure, his life in Manhattan and all of his life seems to embody that kind of, you know, blonde, busty women, and you divorce him after a while. And even though there is, you know, he does hire women to help run the business and promotes women at a time when women weren't being promoted. But the women who are around him, who he seems to marry, are these model playboy kind of, and they may have wonderful minds too, but he touts them as these elite models.
I mean, that's right. There is something fascinating about these two characters who grow up at the same time,
right,
but really grow up in very different cultures. at that same time. So Donald Trump, we talked to classmates of his in military school who told us that sort of Playboy was a Bible at this all-guys military school about how to live your life. And the advice inside Playboy magazine and the model of Hugh Hefner, that this was, you know, seemed like the world, and that this was the world that they wanted to live into, wanted to live in. Hillary Clinton is growing up in a different world, not at an all-guys military school, not growing up with the sort of Playboy lifestyle. She's being exposed to Martin Luther King. She's at the center of 1968 and the 1960s and experiencing all of that, whereas Donald Trump, by all accounts, it barely registers for him, that type of cultural change. And one of Trump's friends, or classmates, I should say, from military academy, said that when he listens to Trump now, he hears echoes of what they called barracks talk, of the way that they looked at the world back then in military school, and that while some of the other students graduated and had to adjust to the real world, that he wonders whether that was something that Trump had to do because of how he went into his father's business, how he went in at the top. So it is a fascinating thing, but I think there's no question that that sort of Hugh Hefner model was something that was influential for Trump.
Let's go next to Patty in Madison. Hello, Patty.
Hi, Kathleen. First of all, this sounds like a documentary for the ages. Who would have ever thought?
Right, who would have thought? You're right.
But I have two questions, and I'll try to make them brief. The first question is, in my vague memory, when I was, you know, first had, like, little boys running through my house, I remember watching Oprah, and I thought that Donald Trump, like, declared he was running for president once on Oprah, and I don't know. Maybe I'm imagining it. And then I'll just follow up my second question, because this conversation is so interesting. Do you feel, after putting this documentary together, that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are a little socially awkward? I mean, Bill Clinton, certainly not, and he fills the room. And I could, you know, as a woman, I met him. He has charisma that, you know, would knock your socks off. But, I mean, they just like the cookie comment in 1992, where you just want to pull your hair out and cringe, you know, even though I decided to stay at home. And just thinking, she gets it, but she can't communicate it. And then he just says things that just, without a filter, like, he never went to kindergarten, you know? I mean, in my Catholic school, if I had talked like that, I would have been in detention for 4 years of high school. So that's just my thoughts.
Thanks, Patty.
You bet.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
Yes, you are not misremembering. Trump was on the Oprah program talking about his run, about potentially running for president. I don't think that he declared he was going to until 2015. But back in the late 1980s, he'd figured out a way to use talk of running for president to get media exposure. And he went on Oprah and on Phil Donahue and on other programs and was talking about trade policies and talking about foreign policy, and was also in the process of selling his book. So that did happen. As far as whether the two candidates are awkward, I think they're both fascinating on this, because their sort of inabilities to relate to people are on different levels. I mean, one of the things that everybody who you talk to who knows Hillary Clinton says is if only everybody knew the real Hillary Clinton, the one that I know, the one who was has been friends, you know, Betsy Ebeling, who's been Hillary's friend since elementary school, and they describe Hillary Clinton that I think many voters would not recognize as warm and funny, mm-hmm. and who asks about their kids and remembers everything that's going on and sends notes. But Hillary, over her life, has found that when she exposes herself, she's attacked. And it was most clear in the early 1990s when she described what she saw as a vast right-wing conspiracy. She's very guarded. And certainly I think some of the talk of affairs with Bill and the scandals around Jennifer Flowers and Monica Lewinsky have to do with that, and some of the other scandals and allegations that have swirled around her. So she's become very guarded. And so when you talk to people who know her, they talk about sort of two different Hillarys. And there's a public Hillary who's very careful, and it's harder for her to connect than this sort of private Hillary. Donald Trump, I think, is the opposite. He's great in large crowds. He knows how to sort of rile them up. He knows how to not be careful and to say what everybody is thinking. He knows how to connect on a visceral gut level with his supporters. And in private, you don't see the type of long-standing friendships that Hillary has. We haven't identified people who are the equivalent of a Betsy Eveling, a lifelong friend of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So they're opposites in this way as well.
Yeah. And back to the secrecy thing, too, which is why I like to learn about the early lives of people. Her relationship with her father, who was drinking too much and abusive to her mother and not a very nice guy, to the point where I think that one of her friends says that she just doesn't want to bring her friends home from school because of what they might encounter inside her house.
That's right. That's what Gail Sheehy, her biographer, said that she found as she was looking into Hillary's childhood. And her father, Hugh, I think is the relationship is probably a little more mixed. I think that there was also a loving relationship there, but he was a demanding presence and, by all accounts, demeaning towards Hillary's mom, Dorothy. And I think from the interviews and reporting we've done, it seems like one of the things that probably motivated Hillary was her mom wanting her to have a better life, and her mom wanting, in some ways, to have Hillary to have the life that she could not have.
More phone calls in just one moment. This Tuesday night, Frontline begins its new season, and it's with a really good documentary titled The Choice 2016. It is about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and it goes back to their childhood, so it fills out a good chunk of their lives. And you find out the things that happened in childhood and in college and who they were then, many parts of the personality remaining as they are the candidates for President of the United States. Our guest this hour is Mike Weiser. He has been doing many documentaries for Frontline, more than 30 actually, since joining the Kirk Documentary Group. He is an award-winning writer and producer. He's reported on American politics, on the global financial crisis, foreign affairs, and the list goes on. The show airs this coming Tuesday, and it will be, you know, watch the debate on Monday, and then you see the Frontline on Tuesday. It'll be a good week for those of us who follow politics pretty closely. It will air 8 o'clock Central Time on PBS. So, more phone calls momentarily. This is, let me give you the number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gary and Merrill, our next caller. Hi, Gary.
Yes, hello. You mentioned Dick Morris as being a kind of a shady character, but you didn't mention that he was the political advisor for the Clintons for 20 years. So that was their choice to have him. I never miss a Frontline. I learned so much from the show. And on a couple of your shows where you went into the Middle East, I think you had said that it was old Bush that planned for the destruction of the Middle East. Then the young Bush attacked Afghanistan and Libya and Iraq, and then now under Hillary and the State Department and our president with the Arab Spring, we toppled Egypt and Libya and we funded ISIS in their beginning and Al-Qaeda in Syria. Any group that would fight against the government of Syria, we backed, and I don't think that's the kind of person we want as president.
Mike.
Well, thanks for your call. First on Dick Morris, absolutely that it was the Clintons who invited Dick Morris in first in Arkansas after they lost the governorship in those 2 years. And then once again, decades later, when they're at the White House and lost after the Gingrich Revolution. And I think it is revealing about Hillary Clinton, about the fact that she believes you need to do what you need to do in order to win. And I think in a lot of ways that's what Dick Morris is the personification of in her life story when you look back at what he was brought on to do in Arkansas, where he tells us that the thing that she liked about him was that he was more willing to go negative and to fight the political fights than Bill might have been. And then again, after the Gingrich Revolution, he's sort of they often say the practitioner of the dark arts of politics, but somebody who understands what do you need to do in order to win, which is part of politics. As far as the history of the Middle East, yeah, there's a lot of reporting on the Frontline site, and we have lots of our old films are up. I worked on a film called The Secret History of ISIS, and we have another film that I did not work on, but that's coming out in 3 weeks, Confronting ISIS. Mm. So there's a lot on the website for anybody who's interested in the big picture history of what happened in the Middle East with ISIS and Syria and Iraq.
And we go to Jean in Tulsa. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jean.
Oh, man, I've been thinking to call in for many, 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 many weeks on this. Where do I start? Give me the Obamas any day. They go low. The Obamas take the high road. Can you imagine if an African-American or a woman said these things that Trump says? It's just crazy. And so is the, like, almost state-sanctioned division in our state. I saw a license plate that said jail her around the Kenosha area when I was heading to Chicago this summer. And the bumper stickers all over about Hillary, anti-Hillary. Now, how can our state put that on a license plate that said jail her about anybody? It's awful. And then I see a sign coming home that said Hitlery for prison. Like a big billboard on 41 near Nina or somewhere. Like, this is just ridiculous. I think we need to vote in 2018, vote in 2022, vote in 2026, and just change this.
Mike.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can respond as to why people feel the way that they do. But one of the things you mentioned was some of Donald Trump's comments on racial issues. And I think one of the interesting things when you look back at Trump's life is that he has not shied away from controversy. Back in the late 1980s, when he was having this initial talk about running for presidency, he decided to insert himself very publicly into one of the most racially charged controversies of the time, which was the Central Park jogger case. And, of course, more recently, he became the most famous spokesperson for the birther movement. So he has not shied away from controversy, and he's not shied away from controversies that have racial elements. And he has not backed down in the face of criticism, in the face of people saying, you know, this is the birther movement is racist. He denies it. So it has been part of Trump's story going back at least to the late 1980s that he's inserted himself into racial controversy. Mm-hmm.
Do you think he believes, Maureen Dowd, we had her on last week, said that she thought that he really believed in a lot of conspiracy theories. Does your research bear that out?
It's hard to know whether Donald Trump believes in the birther theory, whether he was using it shrewdly as a way to get publicity, whether, as he says, he had questions that needed to be answered. One of the interesting moments in making the film was we were talking to Roger Stone, who was, you know, up until the campaign was his longtime political advisor over decades, mm-hmm. And probably the closest person to him in politics. And we said, where did this come from? Where did the birther movement come from? And his answer was the internet. He said, I didn't bring it to him. That Trump probably got it from the internet, and that Trump realized that there was a large segment of the voters, especially in the Republican Party, who had questions about whether the president was legitimate. I think questions which all reporting has said, had been answered long before.
We need to end at this point. We're out of time. Thank you, Mike. Great documentary.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, hope you have a large audience. I'm sure you will. The film airs documentary this Tuesday night, September 27 at 8 o'clock Central Time. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, Scotty Myers for on-air production here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls.